You can keep up with all the episodes of the Journalism Salute by checking out our newsletter. The link is at the bottom of the show notes. Hope you'll subscribe. And let us know where you're listening from and what you think of the podcast. Email us at journalismsalute@gmail.com. Thank you. Hi and welcome to the Journalism Salute. I'm Mark Simon. In each episode, we'll talk to or about an interesting person or organization related to journalism. The intent is to show that journalists are not the enemy of the people. Thank you for listening. On this episode, we're joined by Rebecca Worby. Rebecca is the editorial director for Reasons to be Cheerful. Reasons to be Cheerful is a nonprofit website and newsletter founded by the musician and artist David Byrne. And it is what it says it is, reporting on news that should make you feel good. Many of these reasons to be cheerful come in the form of proven, smart, replicable solutions to the world's most pressing problems. The newsletter has 135,000 subscribers, and the stories in it literally span the globe. Rebecca is based in Brooklyn. She's a writer and editor whose previous job was editing travel guides. She has a master's from Columbia with a master's degree in creative nonfiction. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first up, what's your journalism origin story?
So as you mentioned, I went to graduate school for creative writing, but I was studying creative nonfiction. And because I wasn't writing memoir, I ended up doing a lot of research and reporting and sort of learning all of these journalism skills along the way. My master's thesis was about Moab, Utah, which is, you know, a place that many people know because they visited Arches National Park, you know, beautiful Red Rock Desert. And so I was writing sort of a portrait of the place over time. It was a major uranium boom town back in the 1950s. So I got really interested in that. Long story short, I wanted to write a book, didn't quite work out. I thought it was going to change my life. And it actually did, but not in the way that I thought, but instead by giving me this education in a lot of journalism skills and also specifically the ins and outs of public lands in the American West, which is sort of a complicated thing. So you fast forward a couple years after grad school, I'm having this moment of reckoning. I need to do something different. So I, at age 30, applied for an internship at High Country News, which is a wonderful magazine about the American West based in Paonia, Colorado, although now it's dispersed, but it was based there at the time. Didn't really have a backup plan. I just really wanted this particular position, and I got very lucky. I spent 6 months as an intern and then 6 months as a fellow. So I got to live in Colorado and write for the magazine for a year. It was an incredible experience. And I never could have done that if it weren't for everything that I learned doing my MFA. So it was sort of a roundabout way into journalism.
Rewind here slightly. Is there anything in your family or heritage or where you grew up that lent itself to either storytelling or making people feel cheerful?
I would just say that there are a lot of creative people in my family. So I was very, very lucky that, you know, nobody looked at me like I was crazy when I started saying from a very young age that I wanted to be a writer. I was always supported in that, and I'm very grateful for that.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Wesleyan.
Oh, very cool. I love the idea of a master's degree in creative nonfiction, and I imagine that other people listening would as well. I'm just wondering, what kind of things are taught in that program?
It's a good question. It's been over a decade for me, so I have to sort of go back in time a little bit. But some of my favorite classes were, there was one about research methods. So just like all different ways, you know, library skills to, you know, all kinds of other ways to get information. There was a great class about plot, you know, how to turn life, which doesn't actually have a plot, into plotted stories, and also how to take a lot of the devices that make fiction engaging and use them in nonfiction. There was also just a lot of reading, you know, Joan Didion, George Orwell, lots of sort of classic creative nonfiction. I also took a great class on science writing that the writer Rivka Galchin taught that I think about all the time. We had guests every week, including Rachel Aviv and Oliver Sacks. So I will never forget that.
Okay. Can you take us through the means by which you got to this point?
Sure. So picking up from High Country News, I went from there to Pacific Standard, which was a social justice magazine. I was an associate editor there until the magazine folded, sadly, after I'd been there a little bit less than 2 years. And then I wound up at Wild Sam, which is a publisher of literary travel guides. So a bit of a zigzag, but now, you know, now that you've heard that I come from both a journalism and creative nonfiction background, maybe it makes a little more sense. And I was there for about 3.5 years. I really enjoyed that work. It did use a lot of my journalism skills. I was constantly interviewing people and, you know, doing research about different places. And then I started at Reasons to be Cheerful just about a year ago.
How did you wind up getting that position? Like, how did it come about? Like, that's an interesting transition, certainly.
Yeah, I think I missed journalism. I really enjoyed the work that I was doing, but I was ready for a different challenge and wanted to be, you know, part of the journalism conversation. And also, I think I was particularly drawn to working in solutions journalism. I remembered when I worked at Pacific Standard that the work that I was doing felt really important, but really exhausting. I was editing a lot of our news coverage, and this was like 2018, 2019. The news was not very good. So it's been a really different experience to be now back in journalism, but, you know, reporting and or editing stories about things that are actually working to solve problems in the world. You know, I feel like my sort of dinner party tidbits are all kind of uplifting, which you don't necessarily expect in a journalism job.
I was thinking about this because when I first heard about what this was, my first thought was that it would probably be something similar to John Krasinski's Good News that he did during the pandemic, where he did like this half hour kind of or 20 minute video series. And it was feel good stories, and it was a lot of cute stories, and it was things of that nature. This seems to be a little different than that. This seems to have a different sort of edge. You mentioned the solutions edge to it. Can you explain what the tone of the publication is?
Yeah, so Reasons to be Cheerful, I think the name gets a lot of people in the door because we can all use more of those, but it's a little bit deceiving because our stories are rigorously reported. They're not just feel-good stories. You know, you see the name and you think, oh, positive news, but, you know, we pretty much don't publish a story unless it, you know, contains all the tenets of solutions journalism. So we're really looking for stories of working effective solutions, evidence-based whenever possible. We do try to be upbeat. So I think there is some of that in our tone, but we'll also be straight about the reality of things.
What does your role entail with this?
So as the editorial director on a super small team, I do a lot of different things. I commission and edit most of the stories. I manage our publishing schedule. If you pitch us, I'm probably the person responding. I work closely with our audience engagement manager. I kind of think of my job as like I'm like a managing editor and a regular editor at the same time, but also with some leadership capacity.
Let's take a look at a couple of stories. You can just kind of tell us how they went from initial idea to finished product. One example, a domestic example, and as I said, this is worldwide coverage that you're doing. Make America Rake Again, a story about trying to wean people off gas-powered leaf blowers, which, boy, I very much am in favor of that.
Yes. I wasn't sure about the headline at first. It was something that someone actually said in the story, and I loved it. And then I was like, oh, I'm not sure. And then I was like, ah, I'm going for it. And people responded to it. I think people have very strong feelings about leaf blowers. So this is a good example of a type of story that we do fairly often where either, you know, someone on our team or a freelancer will notice that multiple places are doing something, implementing some kind of solution, often at a policy level. So let's look at, you know, the success that these different places are having, sort of variations on a theme, how widespread is this trend, et cetera. Hannah Wallace is the writer of this piece. She also did a more recent story for us about cities, the ways that cities are trying to discourage the driving of SUVs, which feels very similar in tone, but also was, you know, came out of, you know, a recent regulation in Paris, but then she wrote about other places too. So that's another one that sort of fits in that category. in terms of how it actually went from initial idea to finished product, nothing too exciting, just sort of your basic, you know, Hannah is a writer that, you know, we have a relationship with. She sent a pitch. I liked it. We talked a little bit about the angle, the scope, and she wrote me a draft. We went back and forth on the edits. Yeah.
I love the idea of a series of stories about things that are just general nuisances to people. The gas-powered leaf blowers, SUVs, certainly. And it's cool. Again, that would definitely make me cheerful if there were reductions in both of those. Another one, this one more of a global nature, from Vilnius, Lithuania. And I actually know someone who was born in Vilnius, about Befriend Vilnius, a program that provides mentorship to Ukrainian migrants. Tell us about that one.
Sure. So this one came from the writer Mary Lou Costa, who's written for us quite a bit. She was going to be spending time in Vilnius, and so she knew that she was going to have access and be able to actually meet some of the people in this story. I like this kind of story because it seems like a feel-good story at first, like, oh, how nice, they're making friends, which they are, but it actually is having a practical impact for the people involved, you know, for Ukrainian refugees arriving in Vilnius who, you know, don't know anything from where to get a coffee to, you know, how to fill in different kinds of paperwork. So this mentorship program is actually having a real impact for those people. Yeah, so I don't have too much to add about the process for that one, but it was a cool story.
No, that's fine. The thing that I would ask as a follow-up to that is, how much of your readership is worldwide as opposed to US-based?
Yeah, so I took a look at our Google Analytics because I always try to answer this question and I don't really know by the numbers. The answer is that the majority is US for sure, but we do have a lot of readers around the world, a lot in the UK and Australia, which is not too surprising. But also, if I look at the past year, there's a good number in India, Spain, the Netherlands, France, Germany, New Zealand. I think that's kind of the top echelon of our readers.
I was reading a back and forth that you were having with Will Doig, who is your boss, I believe. And it said, he asked the question, what makes, or maybe it was someone else asked the question, what makes a Reasons to be Cheerful story a Reasons to be Cheerful story? A Reason to be Cheerful story will tell you not just what the solution to a problem is, but also how that solution was implemented. It'll do it in a way that feels conversational and approachable. You don't need to be an expert on sustainable timber construction to understand and enjoy a story about the Portland Airport's new wooden roof. That was your answer. And that was from Will. Yeah, he asked it.
Yeah, that is a good answer. But yeah, I can say a little bit more about that. I think it is important to us that our stories are accessible, that you don't have to have any particular kind of expertise, you know, because sometimes the stuff we're writing about can get kind of wonky or complicated. You know, we did a story recently about 3D printing homes, and you don't need to know how a 3D printer is going to make a whole home to read that story and get something out of it. And yeah, I mean, like I said before, I do think that there is an upbeat quality to our stories, but we don't necessarily look for them to be like cheerful with a capital C. There's a range for sure.
When you say accessible, also, I guess that relates to accessible to people around the world, so to speak, that someone in you know, Lithuania would read it and be able to understand where the writer is coming from. Here's one, and I think this was written by someone from an international background about something that was happening in the United States, and it's pertinent to this podcast, certainly, mm-hmm. How student journalists are stepping up to fill news deserts. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, so this writer, Elizabeth Hewitt, had been living in the Netherlands for some time, but she actually just moved back to the US and is currently living in Vermont. It worked out very well for us because this was a subject that she was interested in and certainly something that I personally have been following. And it just so happened that she was in Vermont at the right time to attend town meeting day, which it just sounds so old timey, but is a very important event. And she got to report on the students covering it. So it was kind of meta, right? She's reporting on the students who are reporting on town meeting day, but then turned it into this much broader look at how student journalists are providing news in places that need it, both through, you know, entire student-run newspapers and just different kinds of J-School programs. But it's a great solution story.
I'll be covering that intensely when we interview some student journalists in May. A recent piece that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, we published a story last week by a writer named Kia Krause, who lives in Maine. The headline was "How Unfamiliar Fish Are Helping Mainers Fight Food Insecurity." It's part of our Waterline series, which is all stories about the intersection of water, food, and climate. It's an amazing story, not the sexiest. You know, you don't think, ooh, food insecurity and fish, and gets, you know, super excited. But I actually really liked the story. It's pretty hard to summarize because it has a lot of different elements, and I thought Kia did a pretty impressive job bringing it all together. It's about a program that started during the pandemic that pays Maine fishermen in the ground fish industry a competitive rate for their catch, and then donates that fish to food pantries and schools. So that's pretty cool. That's, you know, great news for fishermen and, you know, for people in need. And then there's this whole kind of story within the story about these food banks. Kia visits a shopping model food bank, and where she says that over 80% of the visitors speak French, Portuguese, or Spanish as their primary language. So it's, you know, people who have moved to Maine from various other places. And a lot of those places, it's customary to cook with whole fish, which is not as common here in the US. And so these are people who are showing up and are able to get these ground fish like pollock or gray sole and cook them in the style that, you know, they're used to. So it ends up being kind of this amazing cross-cultural story in addition to a story about helping fishermen stay afloat and feeding people.
That story really lives up to not just reason to be cheerful, but reasons, plural. Oh, so we've addressed the writing of others, and I did want to talk about an example of something you wrote. This is for lithub.com. You wrote a piece linking together several crimes, vandalism in national parks, the stealing of Native American artifacts on public lands, which we've talked about in previous episodes, dismantled sculptures. This piece was listed as notable in the Best American Science and Nature Writing 2021. How did the idea for it come about?
So this actually goes back to my writing about Moab in grad school. So that was many years ago. And then, you know, in 2020, this thing happened. This metal monolith appeared in the desert near Moab. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. I was really bothered by it. And I realized that I already knew all of these things that felt relevant to the story in different ways, even if I hadn't entirely figured out how. So I knew that I wanted to write about it.
So what were you trying to convey within the piece?
As I was writing it, I didn't totally know. I think this is a process that's familiar to a lot of creative writers and probably some journalists too. It felt like I was like gathering pieces of string, and I didn't know what they were going to form when I put them all together, but I knew that they all went in the same story. And I think in the end, what I wanted to convey was that this monolith was situated in a place and a history that are both complicated. And I wanted to take this story of the monolith and turn it around, looking at it from all of these different angles, and add all of these other stories to the telling so that people reading it would have a richer understanding.
Did you know that the end was going to be, you have a very, it's just an end paragraph, a kicker essentially. It's very thoughtful and I guess poignant. Did you know that that was going to be your end as soon as you saw, and I'm not going to spoil it for people, as soon as you saw what you saw that led to the end paragraph?
I actually wasn't sure if I wanted to include that or not at various points in the writing, because it's more personal than a lot of the pieces, a little bit more removed, but that's about something that actually happened to me. But it did feel like a really strong note to end on, so ultimately it felt right to put it there.
You mentioned pieces of string, and I'm curious, for as someone with a creative writing background and journalism, like watching the two worlds intersect, what is the process of writing like for you?
Well, with this piece, it certainly, it felt like collecting things. You know, I was like writing all of these very short pieces of it, and they all seemed to be in conversation, but then it was almost like there was the writing stage and then there was the arranging stage, because so much of how this piece came together was about order and just seeing all the ways that different parts could talk to each other. I don't know if that's, if I would say that that's my writing process generally, but I am definitely a gatherer, you know, whether it's, you know, research or creative writing, I like to pick up a lot of information and, you know, then see how it all fits together.
Is writing about the idea, is writing about the outdoors like special to you? It felt like it in reading that piece.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, public lands was, you know, one of my first loves as a writer. And, you know, when I worked in travel publishing, a lot of that really was outdoors writing and place-based writing of different kinds. And that is something I really enjoy.
When you're doing place-based writing, if someone was going to ask you for like the best advice that you could give with doing that, what advice would you give?
Treat the place as a character. You know, places have personalities. They can be written about just as richly as people.
What are the journalism issues that you're most passionate about?
I know that this is something that people have probably said to you a lot recently, but it's hard to think of anything right off the top of my head besides the layoffs that we've been seeing the last few months and longer than that, but really acutely this first part of the year. I worry both for the individual journalists who are looking for work in an increasingly limited market, and also just for all of us, because fewer working journalists and fewer well-staffed journalism outfits just means fewer stories will get told, and that can't be good.
Is there a place for other newsletters, publications of not necessarily the same as the one that you're working at, but kind of these creative thinking, I guess, outlets, for lack of a better term? Do you see a future for them that's significant in the journalism ecosphere?
I hope so.
Reasons to Be Cheerful was founded by David Byrne, artist and musician. How involved is he within what you do?
He is around. He, you know, we share an office with him, so I see him sometimes. He is on our board, so he's involved in that capacity. He's not involved in the day-to-day decisions of the publication. But he does do some Reasons to Be Cheerful events, which are really fun. He just did one actually in Maine, of all places. We were just talking about Maine, about a dam removal story up there. So at these events, he'll talk to people who are involved in a story that we've published. But he's very firm about those events being about the solution, not about him, you know, not about his music or anything like that. This project, he holds it very dear and he takes it very seriously. And he understands that his presence is powerful for people. So he'll show up and do events like that, but he really likes to keep the focus on the journalism.
Do you have a sense as to how Reasons to Be Cheerful might evolve?
I have some sense. I can say that it started out, so this year we're having our 5-year anniversary, and our executive editor, Will Doig, has told me that when they started it, you know, he and David and the other founding editor, Christine McLaren, kind of thought, we could probably do this for a year. They saw it as a limited project, something fun to try, and then maybe they'd run out of stories. So I think for a while it was actually a bit of a surprise that this was a sustainable project, that there are, in fact, enough stories in our, you know, actually pretty broad mandate in terms of, you know, the topics that we cover. So the fact that it is continuing at all is an evolution of sorts. Another big step was in 2022, we started a membership program, which is something that a lot of nonprofit newsrooms have done in recent years. And that has been really great for us, both financially and in terms of building audience and community. From here, I think we definitely want to keep growing our membership program. And we're always thinking about ways that we can speak more directly to and be more in conversation with our audience. So that's something that we're working on a lot. And we're kicking up some new series for the next couple of years and also more events. So I'm excited what is about that.
What kind of reader response do you get on stories?
It's a mix. Sometimes, you know, my favorite kind of response is when somebody says that they want this particular solution to happen in their community or that they've been inspired in some way. That's sort of the dream. But we get a lot more that are, you know, people sort of echoing an annoyance, you know, like the leaf blower story got a lot of people being like, yeah, I hate those. Yeah, I think that covers it. We also, you know, sometimes we hear from, you know, teachers who teach our stories in classes, and I always really like to hear that.
Sure. What's the hardest part of the job for you? Best part of the job?
Just feeling like I'm in a position to make real change potentially in the world. You know, we talk about, you know, impact, which feels kind of jargony, but it's really meaningful. You know, like how I mentioned that, you know, we'll hear from teachers who teach our stories. I love hearing that. Or, you know, even just an individual saying that they read a story and it made them rethink a certain idea or behavior. That's really gratifying to me. You know, obviously, like the bigger stuff is even more exciting. I would love to someday hear that, like, you know, lives were changed, a whole community was changed because, you know, they read about some solution on Reasons to Be Cheerful and then they implemented it. So that's probably a bit down the road, but that certainly gives me a reason to keep going.
What's the hardest part of the job?
I think as gratifying as it is to work in solutions journalism, it is limiting. You know, I will get pitches for fascinating stories that I have to say no to because they just aren't solution stories. Often it'll be a story about some new thing that's just getting off the ground, and I'll have to say, this might be a story for us eventually, but it's not a story for us yet.
You mentioned before how your stories have changed how people might view the world. How has being a journalist shaped how you view the world?
It has taught me that every story leaves something out. I think we can forget that when we're reading things. We feel like we're getting the whole story. But when you're on the other side of it, you know, if you're the one writing it and collecting way more information than you can use, or if you're the one editing it and you're having to shave down the word count, you realize just, you know, how you're only getting one very limited view in any given story.
And then I've added this question in. This will be the first time we'll give it a shot. Why do you do journalism?
It's funny. I took notes, and this is the only one that for some reason I didn't take any. I don't know why. I thought I'd just be able to jump in with an easy question like this. I think I do journalism because writing is the thing that I love, and writing that has an impact on people is really meaningful to me. I also, you know, we've talked a lot about creative nonfiction, and I think that there's so much that they sort of bounce off of each other in a lot of different ways. And so I think being a creative nonfiction writer makes me a better journalist, and being a journalist makes me a better creative nonfiction writer. And so I really like thinking about those two together.
So the show is called The Journalism Salute. We salute you and Reasons to Be Cheerful for your good work, and we ask that you do likewise. Is there a journalist or journalism organization that you would like to salute for their good work?
Yes, I'll give you two, and then you can choose. It's possible that one has been like mentioned recently and I haven't heard it. Or so I would love to shout out Hellgate, which is a worker-owned publication doing really great reporting about New York City and having a lot of fun with it. I moved back to New York in August of last year after several years of living in other places, and was so excited that, you know, Hellgate could now be my local. I love that we're getting more of these worker-owned publications, and Hellgate is just doing really great stuff.
And then the second?
Yeah. I don't know if this is cheating because I worked there at some point, but I'd love to shout out High Country News. It's just a great magazine, and I wouldn't be where I am without it. But also, you know, all these years later, I think it just keeps getting better. They keep broadening what they cover. You know, if you look way back in their archives, it was much more firmly about public lands and the environment. But now they really, they'll tell any kind of story about the communities of the American West. It's gotten really diverse and really rich.
Yeah, they've been mentioned on our podcast, but it's been a while since we've heard about them. Becca Warby, thank you for taking the time to join us. Best of luck with Reasons to be Cheerful.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for listening to the Journalism Salute. Please let us know what you think of the show. You can find us on Twitter at JournalismPod, and you can email us at JournalismSalute@gmail.com.